linguistic objects.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. I'm Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Now, in case you missed our last podcast, Psychedelic Salon number 7, you might want to go back and take a listen, because it's actually the first part of a talk we're going to finish up in this session of the Psychedelic Salon. And it's a presentation given by Zena Allison and Alex Gray at the 2003 Burning Man Festival. When we left off, Allison was just talking about being aware of yourself as a parent. And to be honest with you, that's something I wish I'd known about when I was helping to raise a family myself. So I hope that those of you who are new and prospective parents are taking good notes about psychedelic parenting here. Now we'll pick up the conversation where we left off before we were so rudely interrupted by such a mundane consideration as file size. So sit back, relax, and hear what the Grays have to say about parenting in the psychedelic age.
A lot of people ask us about parenting in the psychedelic age, or we call it parenting in other mind states, because of the mind states conference. And, many of us are users of substances, and in a country where, in a place, in a world, really, where those where that use is illegal, dangerous because of its illegality, as well as dangerous just because of its possibilities of mental instability or inability to cope with the drug situation. But also, many of us, also all of us, I could probably say, have had positive experiences through using substances. So how do we be parents with that fear, you know, that our child might be one of those people that journeys and never comes back, or, you know, we want our child to be safe, we want them to be healthy, we don't want them to get arrested, you know.
And we've interviewed a lot of people about this, you know, people who keep it from their children, who lie to their children, and that's something that we don't do, and we never have done. So basically, you know, our advice is to tell the truth, but only to tell as much truth as a child is ready to hear about psychedelics and about substance use. That they don't want to know everything about it. Basically, they hear that it's wrong, they hear that it's illegal, and they don't want to know about it except for what they ask you. So my advice is to answer the questions only that they ask, not more than what they ask, and not to tell an untruth. And, you know, I also recommend, people have asked me about, you know, should we use drugs while pregnant or while, I'll just tell you what we decided to abstain from all drugs before conception for maybe half a year. We abstained from all substances, including alcohol. And then we abstained from substances during pregnancy and during nursing. I just feel that, you know, I didn't want to pass those substances along to my Buddha. And, I think that young egos are not ready for ego dissolving. So I just feel like that, you know, it's not a bad thing to be abstinent for a little while, knowing that one day you can go back to those practices if they're important to you. Did you just say something you're talking about?
No, this is good.
Let's see. So listen and initiate. So now we have Zena, who's a teenager, who many of her friends are, experimenting. And so now what? You know, well, our practice is, you know, not to be users in her presence very much. She knows that we don't use in her presence because she doesn't want to be a user right now. And so, you know, we don't want to have, basically when Zena was younger, we didn't want any emergencies to come up that we couldn't handle. We didn't want her to find us strange or weird or think that something was off about mom and dad, you know. We wanted to offer her stability, you know, and sort of a regular regularity.
Opportunities when she was not around to smoke. And I do think that it's been my experience, and it's probably because of cultural practices, that the young people that are Zena's age, 14, that are smoking, are not smoking responsibly, and that they're not drinking responsibly either. And this is what they say, what the studies show, and it probably is because of cultural practices, but that ninth and tenth graders at this point are not casual or moderate users. There are no casual, moderate ninth and tenth grade users. They are experimenting to they drink until they throw up. They drink until they're really way drunk. They don't know about moderation. By the time they're in 11th and 12th grade, they learn about moderation, or they give it up altogether, or they become addicts. This is what I've been told and what I've read. And I think that young users tend to not have that sense of responsibility about it. And when they have their lives, their activities to attend to, and they're growing, it could become a real distraction from manifesting their best performances in their life. And I kind of thought it would be better. We both sort of thought it would be better if she waited. You know, we asked Zena why her friends were all experimenting and she wasn't. Why do you think that you haven't tried it and so many of your friends are trying? Because she goes out with friends that, and they are doing it in the parties, and sometimes, in the beginning she would leave, but sometimes she doesn't leave. They just smoke and she just doesn't do it. And we wondered why. And she gave us two answers. Usually you don't mind me quoting you. I remember it vividly because it's one of my favorite subjects is parenting and drugs. So, but anyway, what she came up with, which I think she's very wise, is number one that she's been a professional actress since she was seven. So she has her own identity. She has developed an identity as an actress and as a professional person, as a her interests are very strong with her. Her passions are very strong. And in having those passions, she doesn't feel like she needs to, identify, have this as an identity. A lot of her friends are using it to individuate. They're I smoke, and they're one of the first ones to smoke, and this and that. So, she doesn't need that. And if she didn't have acting or the things that she does well, she might actually try it. That's what she said. She might actually try it just to kind of stand out in the crowd.
Well, since everybody's doing it now, it's not like you're standing out and it's not like you're original. So, not doing it is original. That's not what I was, thinking this whole time, but, I'm not, trying to be original to be, but that's true.
Okay, I just wanted to say one thing that was basically, when I was, 12, 13, I had friends who were tripping, And for some reason, I was kind of depressed at that time. And I just didn't do it. And I didn't do it until like I was 21 and I met Allison. And of course, and it was a wonderful, incredible experience. It's changed my life. And I have always been a great supporter of this capacity that psychedelics have to sort of add a transformative catalyst to our consciousness. But it's really hard for me to say, looking back, I might have been able to have that early on, you know, if I had just ventured in to the abyss and swum around, maybe I could have found my way through the sort of depression years of teenagehood. It's really impossible for me to say right now. It worked out perfectly for me as far as my relationship and use of acid, and I've been an advocate of responsible sacramental use ever since. But the it's really tough. Those times are just completely individual decisions that have to be made. But
I think that sometimes young people hear about, like, their older brothers and sisters that may be going to trans parties or some things, and some people do that responsibly and find a way to, at its most positive, these are incredibly bonding experiences with a person, with themselves, when they're dancing on ecstasy or something like that. The guards are dropped down, and you're able to see each other as expressions of this divine energy that you're one with, that the universe is a perfect place, it's a perfect teaching machine that you're part of. And so these, if they're very positive experiences and people are able to at least communicate a little bit about them and say that there are these possibilities, this is the whole thing about, you know, why there's so much fucked upness about drugs, I think, is this loss and lack of communication. It's one of the things that Rick is trying to heal by being out there with the MAPS Journal and by and all of the efforts that people are doing when they're telling a story that's appropriate of a trip. That, well, one day I had an experience that, you know, just say, I took LSD and this happened. Or if we were able at appropriate times. I know my parents have never liked to hear that that I had these experiences while taking psychedelics, but I've never shied away from sharing that. And I think that the more people that do share whether these experiences are of significance, the more a growing tide of recognition that there is this possibility inherent in these substances, the entheogens. That Houston Smith, you know, was able and willing, now it is practically 80 or something, to come out and publish all these essays about cleansing the doors of perception. He's the world's leading authority on religion and comparative religion. And so for him to say that this was one of the most important experiences in his life, it sends a message, a credible message, to a certain class of folks who are, have ears to hear. And so slowly, I think that we may be able to get this message out. And each of us talking to folks and to try to counter the drug war propaganda that has really jailed the minds of young, you know, putting bars over these possible portals into the infinite. You know, many of us living in this materialistic kind of focused culture are unable to open our doors of perception without these kind of explosives. So it's an important message to keep getting out. The Washington Post did an article on the on this show that Allison and I are in Baltimore, and one of the things was the headline in the Post was linking psychedelics and spirituality. You know, it was wonderful just to see it, even if it was just a blast for a minute. You know, the more that we can get that message into whatever media possible, the more it as someone said, the point of propaganda is not to make people believe what you're saying. It's to make them doubt the other shit that they're hearing. So we can use these counter propagandistic stories and memes dropped into as little tinctures dropped into culture at various points, that we can at least make people doubt the drug war propaganda. There was a question as to whether the art establishment looked down on or blacklisted an artist because of their known drug use and not being shy about talking about it. The thing is that they don't talk about that. You just don't ever hear from them. And I've not heard from a lot of folks. So I think that Burning Man is what I think of as the most effulgent, inspirational concrescence of creative energy on the planet. And I don't think anyone could doubt it or could counter it with another, well, what about this? Well, it's just, well, that's very cool. They're all very cool, actually, and we don't want to denigrate any, but I just say, since we're here right now, we can recognize that expression. And what do we use art for anyway? Yes, there is a pecking order, and do this most famous person in history, and they're in the art magazines, and they get a review, and all the rest of those things. All you can do is to just make the work that you want to do, you know, and maybe you don't want to tell this curator that you were tripping when you were doing that picture or something. That's up to you. Or maybe it's an opportunity for educating that curator that, not unlike Keith Haring, who's a world famous artist of the 80s and grew great inspiration, in fact credited his entire body of work to the trips that he took. Maybe it's an opportunity for education about the opportunities that these substances can have for artists. They're visionary substances. We're working with, as painters with a visual medium, or as filmmakers or various other kind of visual media. They could be incredible tools in the toolbox of the artists of the 21st century.
I just wanted to say that we all know that it's important for us to stand up and stand behind the things that have moved and inspired us the most in our lives. And, what else is there to living? You know, if you're a Christian and being a Christian has moved and inspired your life, you want to tell everyone about it. If what really moves and inspires you and has really, been behind all of your work, your best things, you would want to talk about it and stand for it and not hide from it. But you want to do that responsibly and to the degree that you don't hurt yourself.
There's a question about where did I get my level of knowledge and understanding about anatomy? Anatomy has always been a great fascination to me. My mother pulled out early drawings that I did when I was 5 and 10 and things like that, and they were drawings of skeletons. So evidently it's always been a subject that I've been interested in, the subject of mortality, because the skeleton, of course, in our anatomy, when we're looking at our internal anatomy, we're often thinking, ew, guts, gee whiz, I'm gonna die, it's like less avoidable as a, like I'm a meat thing, and so when you recognize that, it's always been a potent symbol for me, the greatest symbol as human beings in human bodies that we have, to seeing that we are impermanent. On the other hand, it's a universal that we share with each other. So it's a way to make a universal kind of self-portrait, is to make the skin more translucent and to focus on the internals. So my interest in the subject came about through starting to also, it was catalyzed by this tripping episodes where I knew that, well,
I want to make art about consciousness. That's the subject. That's, you know, meaty subject. So it's the most important thing to me, you know, in all of its spectrum. So we're living this consciousness through this body. So I better understand what it is, this package, and this kind of black box that consciousness comes in, so that I'm able to speak with some kind of believability or authority about the consciousness that's moving through it. So that was the job and the predicament, and then I just taught myself the anatomy by doing the sacred mirrors. That was the whole thing, okay? Learn the nervous system. It's been mapped out before, you know? So we just, okay, go through that. This nerve goes here, this nerve goes there. And you look at the bones. I already was a, you know, fairly decent craftsman as far as rendering skills and things like that. So I just went into approaching, educating myself by getting all, you know, tons of anatomy books. And I got a job in a morgue for 5 years where I was able to do dissection work to prepare bodies and to see the fabric of our, you know, physical flesh at a very close range and to understand how things fit together. Then I taught anatomy for 10 years for artists where we would... if you want to learn the anatomy and the gross anatomy, one of the best ways is to sculpt the skeleton. You know, get an armature and sculpt the bones, each one individually, and then put the meat on the bones, you know, put on the muscles. And this can all be done in clay. It's called an écorché. This is how we taught, how I taught anatomy for 10 years. It's a wonderful way to teach it. The other way is just to draw it all the time, you know, just keep drawing it or paint it like I did in the sacred mirrors. And yeah, I was a medical illustrator also for about 15 years. So all of that helped in learning the anatomy. Yeah. Thanks for asking. He asked or commented that he heard that there was a benefit for the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors recently. There's been a few, some in San Francisco, and which I may have met some of you, and a couple in New York. And the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors is a dream that we want to bring out into the world, lead the world. It's basically a house for this collection of art, the Sacred Mirrors, and numerous other paintings and things, works of transformative art. And we want to build a 21st century sacred architecture, and it can take a lot of pointers from David Best and the pyramids that are appearing here. I'd love to talk with anybody who's connected with all that. We've been working with an architect, Keith Critchlow, and we've found a spot in upstate New York at Omega Institute that has been very welcoming to this project, and so right now we're focused mostly on the actual chapel being built there. There are some restrictions as far as height and things like that we have to work with in that space, but right now the most exciting thing regarding the chapel is the space in Chelsea. Chelsea in New York City is the heart of the art world. And that's where the action is of, like, hundreds and hundreds of galleries, and even museums are there in Chelsea. And we've been given the opportunity to open a 5-year space at, 530 West 27th Street on the fourth floor. We're given 3,400 square feet, and we've designed a space that we can... Although the sacred mirrors, which I've always envisioned in the ultimate chapel, is being in a round room, these will be in a kind of a long hallway. But all the sacred mirrors will be there. There will be about 20 other works as well. So it will provide at least a space for now that we'll be able to visit and see the work, hold events, possibly do, hopefully do, fundraising for building the actual architecture. that we'll be able to then move these pieces into. If we can raise $5 million in this 5 years, I think that we'll have moved significantly forward to be able to actualize this chapel project. Thanks very much.
So if you're in New York, and if a lot of people pass through New York on their way from here to there, whatever, you have to come and see us. And we will have events like, we already have a monthly full moon prayer gatherings. We will have Art Sabbath, where we draw the model and paint and listen to music and show portfolios and groove. And we have a fabulous shaman who holds ceremonies and other wonderful religious interesting religious leaders that chant and do various events there. But our Art Sabbath is going to be a big draw, and we'll have parties. And it's in a building called Spirit New York, so you'll want to come. It'll open in the fall. Spirit New York is going to have a sort of rave club, and it's going to have, you know, a restaurant and a bar and massage and yoga and hydrotherapy. And it's a whole building called Spirit New York. So Spirit is in New York. It's going to be in New York, and we're going to be part of that, and we're being corporate sponsored by Spirit New York to have it. So when you come to New York, definitely come and see Spirit New York and come to the chapel.
New York
needs it. You know, you guys are out here, and it's wonderful in California and whatever, but New York really needs this. And maybe if we get the chapel all done, we will do another one in California, because we have lots of friends out there. It's sort of a dream. Yes, at a great financial sacrifice to ourselves, who are not rich people. We did not sell any of the sacred mirrors, although we have had offers made for the entire body of work. We had a sort of a ecstasy experience where we realized that we needed to hold on to these works and keep them for people. And then there are the other 20 or 30 pieces that we have not only kept from selling, some of the best loved works of Alex's that we have not sold, but also have been buying back. We have bought back several pieces. We're right now in the process of repurchasing a piece called Prostration, which went on sale. The collector was looking for another collector and would not donate the piece to the chapel. We have many collectors who were willing to donate some of the best works, praying and kissing and some of the, you know, really recognizable pieces back to the chapel when we have it, but this collector was not and wanted the money, and so we have been raising money to buy back Prostration. So if it's a meaningful piece to you, or if you have those kind of, that kind of ability to donate, we have projects like our collection fund where we do purchase back. Last year we purchased back nursing. We felt that it was important to have it in the series where you have pregnancy, birth, you know, nursing, family. These are like a series of paintings that we felt needed to be together and should be seen together. It should be seen by people. It should be public and not just owned in someone's apartment.
We
like to provide images, and we try to do that on our website. You know, we try to provide, you know, prints, and small paintings are for sale still to try to, you know, motivate more collectors, and because you've got to get collectors to be interested in the work. But the larger and more important pieces that belong together really belong to people, and we're hoping that the chapel will be a public and permanent space for the work to be seen.
The question was, what was my experience working with Poole?
We're here.
Thank you. I love Tool. It's been one of the most inspiring collaborations that I've ever been fortunate enough to engage in. A friend, Eli Morgan, and I've been working on a book for this that kind of is a catalog of our collaboration, starting with the CD and the story of how Adam approached me. Adam Jones is the lead guitar for Tool, and he's an artist. He's an amazing artist. He's a filmmaker, and his drawings of sort of mutant humans are really hilarious and terrifying. So he loved my work, evidently, and met me at a gallery
exhibit of one of my some of my art, and then he started talking about the possibility of working together. So every time it's just been Adam calls up and says, "Hey, you know, I'm doing this music video. Would you like to add 1 minute to it? You know, at the end." And it's sort of, we need a transformation at the end. So he's been very open about, you know, like, whatever you want to do. You know, just here's, we have the computer animators, let's work together. And then he called up a couple weeks before their tour and said, do you have any ideas for stage sets? And so I had a few, we went back and forth, and then they made these magnificent 30 by 60 foot banners that were in their last tour in the Sacred Mirrors, and many of the banners there. And it was astonishing to me to see how they took it and integrated, how integrated I felt like their music and the performance of it in this last tour was with the artwork. It was I was completely floored.
It's amazing.
Yeah, thank you.
I just wanted to say that being involved with Tool for Alex's work really expanded the audience for the work. And you know, the goal of any artist or anyone, a musician or whatever you're doing, is to make more friends. That's our feeling about it. And so we made a lot more friends because Tool invited Alex to be part of what they were doing. Love. Love is all there is. I also wanted to say that in expanding friends, our network of friends, even further, Alex just finished doing the cover of a CD for the String Cheese Incident. And this is another entire genre of music, you know, a separate genre entirely, so that, you know, so that there's a big String Cheese contingent here. So I wanted to make sure that we mentioned that, and that this hasn't come out yet, but, you know, we're incredibly honored to be part of, you know, the jam band scene and all those friends that we can make in another whole genre of music.
Oh.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, my daughter here is a visual artist, and I'm just wondering, there's sort of a debate about art school yes or school no. What is your opinion?
Okay, a parent who is here with their daughter, which is totally awesome, and she asks, what's your opinion about art school? And art school, yes, no, she's an artist. And, well, you know, I had a spotty relationship with art school. I think that if you know what you want to do already, and you think that a community that you could link up with at a particular school would be helpful in educating yourself and connecting with other people, you know, if you think that the environment there can be helpful, and you already have sort of a direction, then it's probably not a bad thing. You know, it could be helpful. My personal experience was that I kind of had a direction, and the art school wanted me to do a million other things, you know, instead of fulfilling what I was interested in. This is my basic complaint with all educational institutions, is that they don't do an assessment of the individual and see what their best at in their lives and what they love doing, and then accelerate that, you know, or speak to that and inform that. You know, that's what I'd like a real educational institution to do, is to care about the developing intelligence of whoever they're working with. And each kid is a little bit different, you know. And so try to foster that, just not try to force you through this pasta cutter, you know, that cuts off all your creativity and dreams and things. So, at any rate, I went to 2 years of an art school in Columbus, Ohio, that was like that, like the pasta variety. And I had to leave. I had a 4-year scholarship, but it was so disgusting and distressing that I left. And then I painted billboards for a year. And I had to raise money. My parents weren't giving me any money to go through art school or anything.
And so I raised some money, and I found a really weird artist, Jay Jaroslaw, and I was so fascinated with his work that I wanted to go and study with him. He was teaching at the Boston Museum School. So I saved my money, and I decided to leave Ohio and go study with this guy. And it was a great year. He was the guy that gave me acid for the first time, and it was in his class in relation to him that I met Allison. So, you know, art school for me was not about necessarily making the art, but it did, it was a place where I was inspired eventually to become, you know, the kind of artist that I am. So I left school after that. I never got a degree. And I had a perverse thrill in teaching at a university because of that. And so I advocate, if you know exactly what you want to do and you want to just do that, you know, instead of like spending the money on art school, you know, buy yourself a computer and various other kinds of accoutrement that might accelerate your art product and doing what you want to do, make an investment in yourself and your vision, and you can skip all that nonsense. Otherwise, if you feel like there's a community that you'd like to be part of, because frankly, a lot of the artists who've made it big, you know, and like David Sally and a number of his friends and things like that, they met in art school, at Cal Arts, you know, and there was kind of a bubble of artists that at least knew each other, and there was a cadre that kind of took over the art world for a while. So if you're interested in the kind of political scene that is the art world as well, and it's, you know, it's part of a game to play, I'm not against playing that game with the art world. We want to transform the world. We don't want to exclude the art world, you know. So we have to, in some way, participate if we can. If there's ways of participating with the whatever this legitimate art world is that we all imagine, that's in the art magazines and things like that. How are we going to transform culture if we can't also insert our dreams into that world? So we shouldn't exclude them, you know. And so be part of that if you can, you know.
Just briefly wanted to say that I, you know, from the on the other side, I got advanced degrees in art. I went to art school and then went to more art school and then got more degrees. But for me, it was like, you know, I had the resources. I was lucky enough that my parents could afford to pay for that. And I left the pasta cutter school also and went to this school that I met Alex, where you basically did whatever you wanted to do. And for me, going to school and getting more degrees was about my parents could help me to live and survive up to the point where I finished school. Then I'd have to go out and get a job. So I thought, oh, the longer I stay in school, you know, the more art I'll be able to make. And it was really, and they were up for it. If I got a master's degree and whatever, I could take some academic courses along with it, and I was okay with that. So, you know, it was all enjoyable. And you do meet a lot of people, and all the equipment is there. Like, if you want to learn to work in the photo lab, you don't have to have a photo lab. If you want to do silk screening, you don't have to have a silk screening studio. You can learn, and all the equipment is there. So if that's meaningful to you, and you're not being restricted too much, as we both were in our, you know, pasta cutter schools that we started off with. You know, and if you feel like the school doesn't restrict you can get a lot, but don't take what your teachers say too seriously. We're really all always appalled, and most people are, by teachers who want their students to make work that looks like theirs or have really definite dogmas about, like, what is okay, what is art and what isn't art, what is okay to, you know, how art should look and how it shouldn't look. You gotta, you know, basically be, you know, Teflon and impervious to all that, you know, if you go to school.
And thank God for those who are willing to support the arts. You know, we wouldn't have Vincent van Gogh's work at all unless his brother was there supporting him, you know. So parents who support kids in their art, you know, I salute you. And anyone who is supporting the arts, it's like, thank God. You know, hey, we love you. All right, I think we got to wrap this up. So thanks so much, everyone. I really want to say, Dan, Allison, Alex, Gray, and to all of you people out in the sun and the outer periphery, thank you all for being here.
you again to Zena, Allison, and Alex, not only for that great presentation, but also for braving the noontime conditions on the playa. And for those of you who want to learn more about this family of great artists, you should check out their personal websites. Zena's is www.zenagrey.com, Z-E-N-A-G-R-E-Y.com. Allison's is allisongrey.com, allisongrey.com, and of course, alexgrey.com for Alex. And if you'd like to hear the rest of our 2003 Planeta Norte lectures that were held at Burning Man that year, before we get them all into podcast format at least, you can just go to planquenorte.org. That's planquenorte.org. Or you can get there from the front page of our main website, which is matrixmasters.com. And again, I'd like to thank my friends at Chateau Hayuk for the use of their wonderful music here in the Psychedelic Salon, which, by the way, is a cut from their CD, Nature Loves Courage. Well, that's it for now. I do hope you'll join us in the next Psychedelic Salon when we'll be bringing you Michael Brownstein's talk from the 2004 Burning Man Festival. Michael titled this talk, Waking Up from the American Dream, and I think you're going to find it quite absorbing, and for sure Michael will give you a lot to think about. So for now, this is Lorenzo, signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.